To hear the full episode, become a patron at patreon.com/deathpanelpod.
I think one thing that I would love for us to get into a little bit, because it's a sort of another big aspect of this piece, is there were a lot of critiques of labor and racial and carceral capitalism that you sort of came across embedded within these letters, critiques of the prison system, ways that disability and unproductivity, uselessness are being leveraged strategically. And I'd love for us to get into some of those other examples that you talk about in the article. And yeah, so can you just sort of talk about what were some of these critiques that were leveraged? And I guess it would be interesting also to sort of, in the instances where we do know how the state responds, to talk about sort of how the state reacts to some of these petitions and framings and arguments that women make.
Yeah, let's get into it, because that is the part of the article that I think I really hope folks who are either listening, or if they choose to go read the article, that they'll walk away and that will leave a lasting imprint. It certainly did for me.
Likewise. And, yeah.
Yeah. And particularly because this is not a history that is told of a consistent strategy that works. This is a history in which we are trying to understand how we identify, and this is a direct allusion to Sarah Haley, sabotage within the prison, even when it cannot destroy it. Whether that, you know, destruction we think about is literally destroying the prison, or, you know, being able to get out of the prison yourself. So I think a great place to start would be with a 32-year-old woman named Mary Alexander. And in 1923, she wrote to the governor. And you'll notice I also, from reading Pearl Finley's letter here, folks might notice that this is quite common. Incarcerated people are writing directly to the governor. And in this case, Mary Alexander was writing to the same governor as Pearl Finley. So in 1923, Mary Alexander wrote about an illness that was really plaguing her. And she talked about it not necessarily in the specificities of the medical language, which, again, like, I'm sure we both have a lot to say about what is seen as legible or, you know, actually verifiable in the language of the, you know, medical community. And for her, she described this condition as, one, it made her immobile. She had been confined to a bed for quite some time. She'd been incarcerated for 9 years and 2 months. And she was having what she described as bowels and rectum trouble. And at the end, she just says she had, quote, always done the best she could do, end quote, in her work. But the first parole request was denied. And so in a second letter she sends 2 months later, it's clear there's a shift in her rhetorical strategy and how she's going to write about. And again, my question is not really about the intentionality of that. My question is about the fact that there's a shift that happens in these letters and what occurs in the aftermath of that shift. So she, in the second letter, she begins by recounting a surgery that she had undergone between the writing of the first and now this letter. And this time she's not really describing being confined to bed, but really emphasizes work. And she writes, quote, I am not able to work any at all. I have been sick for 2 years and 10 months, first up and down, and now I am down and can't do anything, end quote. And it's clear that she's making a very clear argument that there is no possibility for her to perform any labor. And we don't, again, and I think a lot about in terms of Liat Ben-Moshe's decarcerating disability, that I don't want to say there's linear causality here, that the second letter leads to her receiving a temporary parole 2 months later. And instead, I like to think about this as, you know, well, conditions of possibility, as Ben-Moshe writes in a part of her book. You know, what are the conditions of possibility? And it seems to me that the emphasis on work created a particular condition of possibility that seemed to allow for a shift in how the state responded. And I'd just like to pause here for a second, because I know that this is also a very different context. If folks who are listening, if you don't work on the early 20th century, especially like the Southern carceral state, prisons in the South. And you're more familiar with the contemporary context of prisons and jails, you're probably feeling like there's probably something happening for you where you're thinking, this is interesting that there is no discussion of innocence or quote guilt or the reason for the incarceration, right? Like we might imagine would happen in front of a parole board today. And I want to make sure that I give a little bit of room for that context because you all are not working with my archives. And so this is something that other folks have noted to me when they come across my work. And sometimes when we're working in an archive, we get so used to things and we forget that this is new context. So let me just speak to that for a second and say that that did not often come up in Black women's letters once they were incarcerated. Sometimes in the sentencing statements, Black women would make certain, give context for the charges that were brought against them, which we know from Sarah Haley, Talitha LaFloria, and my own work that a lot of these have to do with self-defense, of course. But these letters, it's clear, they understand, this is actually evidence. If you're thinking like, why is this the strategy? It's because this is evidence of how the prison system officials understood the prison system, that they were not concerned. They had little concern. Once they convicted and processed and brought someone into the penitentiary, into one of the prison camps or another prison, they did not have a lot of concern about the quote conditions of innocence or guilt. They were highly, highly motivated by labor and the political and economic crises of the prison. They were always concerned about, you know, whether the prison was paying for itself, whether they were generating income for the state. And that's what I want to point to is Black women's expertise on this. They lived it. They experienced that labor regime, which I do write about in my larger project. It's very complicated. It's undergoing a lot of changes. And if folks are interested, when my book comes out, you're like, please go read and think with me about that. But I just, in this moment, I want to point to the fact that this is evidence of Black women's expertise in the political economy of the prison. And that actually, the only way they were legible is not if they were suffering, not if they were in pain, not if they understood themselves to be, you know, innocent or falsely charged. They knew that the way to communicate with the warden, with the governor, with the high up officials was about their labor. And that expertise is really important for us to better understand what were the conditions of disability in the prison, but reciprocally, how were they both making a critique of carceral racial capitalism, but intimately understanding what they needed to do to get out of it.
I think it also ties this beautiful connection, again, also to the context of disability coming into being as a kind of legal category of the state, specifically around the idea of the worthy and unworthy poor, the idle poor, and the working poor, and the ways that the prison is directly, you know, in the lineage of the poorhouse, as are asylums and nursing homes and so many other care organizations. But, you know, the sort of hinge point on what makes you deserving of the release is so clearly sort of evidenced in the discussion around capacity to work. And as you're pointing out, not around, you know, did I do the crime or not, or asserting innocence, right? It's that you are sort of deserving of being released from the penal labor structure only when you can prove that through no fault of your own, your capacities are of no use to the state.
Yes. And what we find is that actually, even if you received the temporary parole or a parole after this negotiation with the state, that the prison lurked. It lingered. Surveillance. And I talk about the expansion of surveillance in my larger book project about the encroachment of prison violence into places that were not prisons. And we see this with Mary Alexander.
Yeah.
She gets a few extensions on her temporary parole, but then there's a call that happens between a warden and one of the state officials who has somehow gotten or made up this information. We don't know, of course, but uses the language of, quote, I am reliably informed, and has kind of seen, or, you know, basically says that Mary Alexander is working in this underground economy of an illegal drinking salon, because, of course, this is during Prohibition, and Prohibition lasts like way longer in Alabama. I mean, maybe you can fact check me on how in relation to other states, but my sense is it lasts quite a while. And so even though she was released under the terms of an inability to work, this piece of surveillance about her actually means that she gets sent back to the prison immediately. And as I write in the article, even if it's kind of the so-called illegality of the, you know, illegal drinking salon that she was possibly working in or frequenting or happened to walk by with friends or whoever, her return to prison was always going to be understood as a compulsion and thus capacity to labor. And so it's reneging. It's kind of going back on those terms of, oh, you actually can work. And that's what we see happening in terms of the precarity and vulnerability of Black women who have entered the carceral state, who have been in prison. Leaving prison was not a guarantee of safety, was not a guarantee of permanence. And that is something momentously horrific that is devised under the prison system.
Yeah, and as you write in your article, the day that the warden receives this letter is the day, or the day the warden's letter is received, right? Because it's the warden writing to the prison officials. The parole is revoked. You know, the condition of the capacity to labor in many ways sort of stands in for the presumed prognosis in a different process of diagnosis that you might associate more with, you know, medicine, for example. The idea is sort of, well, is this person sort of in the right space relative to their capacities? And is that capacity being taken, you know, to the fullest advantage of? Or is this person not, quote unquote, productive, and therefore it's more efficient for that person to no longer be under the care of the state? I mean, these kinds of cost-benefit negotiations, which again, you know, that's an ahistorical framing, because technically cost-benefit analysis as a science doesn't enter politics until many decades later. However, as an ideology, the precursors for what becomes named cost-benefit analysis and becomes entrenched as a formal tool of policy analysis later, ultimately, you know, exists in the prison industrial and administrative record quite obviously. And this is a really good example of that, where part of the hinge point that would sort of put someone in one category or another, right? These branches where diagnoses splits. This is, in many ways, the state's also looking for things like work capacity, surplus labor, and judging truth and verifiability around these assumptions of sort of, if someone is in a place of leisure and drinking and, you know, or illegality, right? Are they actually a deserving poor? I mean, there's so many instances of this that we live with all the time around people who are looking for benefits, cheats and fakers, folks who are malingerer hunting, you know, forums that chase chronically ill people online and say they're not really sick, to, you know, the formal parole system, right? And the idea of supervised release of any kind. And ultimately, the administrative record, while it doesn't, you know, say this explicitly, it gives us such an interesting picture as to the role that prisons play in the broader political economy, and the role that this, as a locale of captive surplus labor, is crucial to the functioning of the administrative state of Alabama and to the larger administration of the United States as a whole.
Yeah, and the question of political economy is really central to us understanding with greater specificity and precision that slavery is not simply a continuum and an analogy for what's happening with prisons. I know, you know, I take the lead from a lot of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated theorists and scholars over decades who have thought about the relationality between slavery and prisons, and some of whom in arguments have strategically created metaphors between, you know, analogized the two. But I also think what Black studies specifically really demands of us is to think, again, with great specificity about both the ways that we see, again, to invoke Hartman, Sadia Hartman, the afterlives of slavery, but to think about it with great attention and precise attention, rigorous attention to the very specific ways that prisons are both resurrecting, reviving, re-implementing specific tools of surveillance and violence from slavery, and the ways that they're imagining themselves beyond it. And so one of these questions for the book project is about labor and political economy. And it's a very complicated story. And again, you know, my book is not out yet, but when it comes out, hopefully, folks will be able to think with me and engage with some of my arguments, which is that labor is not the only way that we understand the relationship between slavery and prisons. In fact, it has a lot to do with space and geography, surveillance. And these are very specific modalities that, of course, have a lot of interplay. They have a lot of importance in our understanding of the administrative state, the medical state, how folks are encountering the attrition of care. And for Black women specifically, I mean, this is coming in the context of just the absolute dearth of access to care, either autonomous care, care that can be guided by the person themselves, to the actual physical distance of what it means to live in the segregated U.S. South, where you cannot enter a hospital that is close to you, and instead you might have to find someone with a car or take a bus in order to get to a hospital that is specifically, you know, segregated for Black people. And so there is so much here. And I think this just brings our attention to all of these different structural dynamics that are informing every single time that an incarcerated Black woman was negotiating with the state, experiencing medical care within the state, and then dealing with the aftermath, if there was an aftermath of incarceration.
To hear the full episode, become a patron at patreon.com/deathpanelpod. You'll get access to this and the rest of our catalog of patron-only episodes, and be the first to get a new patron episode every Monday when it drops. With love, the Death Panel.